Chapter 5. The Leopard had lost the northeast trades in 12 degrees 30 minutes north, far earlier than Jack had expected. He resisted the notion of total loss as long as he could, but presently he was forced to admit that it was so. That this year the doldrums had moved farther north than usual, and that his ship was in them, well in, having carried the declining breath of the true breeze right down to its last expiring waft. Day after day she lay there, with her head all round the compass, inanimate, her sails hanging limp, sometimes rolling so that most hands were sick all over again, rolling so heavy that he struck her topgallant masts before she should send them overboard, sometimes motionless. And all day long the heat beat down from a veiled sun. The air was thick, with no refreshment even in the morning watch. Lightning flickered all round the night horizon, and sometimes by night, but more often by day, warm rain came down so hard and thick that the men on deck could hardly breathe, and the scuppers on either side spurted water as though from a powerful hose. Sometimes, after these blinding downpours, a breeze would spring up, and he would have the Leopard's head towed round to make something of it. But it was rare that the breeze was on the ship herself. Far more often it ruffled the sea half a mile or more away, and then the boats would labour, double-banked, to get her there before it died. Vain, exhausting labour, 9 times out of 10. And these breezes, such as they were, might come from any quarter. They were as likely to push her back as to help her on. Almost all the time she lay in much the same few square miles of sea, surrounded by her own filth, with empty casks and floating bottles from the wardroom. Yet this stretch of sea was itself in motion. Whenever he could take a good noon observation or a double amplitude, Jack fixed his position. A perfect sight of the moon and Altair proved that the chronometers he'd indulged in, a superlative pair, the pride of their maker, were still within seconds of Greenwich time, and that this sea in which the Leopard wallowed was very slowly drifting west and a little south, in a circular motion that would require so great a time for its completion that he looked away from his reckoning. Like every other sailor, he'd heard of ships in the doldrums lying helpless for weeks and even months, eating their stores and accumulating weed. He'd had severe experience of it himself. And as he examined the sky, the sea, the drifting weed, the birds and fishes, the feel of the air, and all those minute differences that mean so much to a man bred to the sea, it appeared to him that the Leopard was in for a very ugly bout. A gloomy ship now, oppressed by heat and disease and dread of the future. At one time a school of whales passed by, sperm whales on either side, spouting, moving steadily along the surface, half awash, diving, reappearing farther on. Some 50 huge, calm, dark forms travelling fast, some so close to the ship that he could see their blowholes open. One was a female with a calf no longer than the Leopard's launch. Although the ship had half a dozen whalers among her people, there was not a sound as the school moved past. The crew, frightened by the jail fever, dispirited, worn out by towing, merely looked over the side. An apathetic stare, no more. At another time a great deal of weed appeared, perhaps some slow streamer from the remote Sargasso Sea, and with it a number of birds that he'd never seen before. It was no use sending for Stephen, however. Stephen was shut into the forepart of the ship. It had been transformed into one vast sick bay, sealed off by bulkheads, forbidden territory from which he never emerged except for the daily burials. Very early in the epidemic he'd fumigated the whole ship, section by section, with great quantities of brimstone, while the hands were sent into the boats or the tops. Then he'd retired with all his patience, desiring Jack to have the bulkheads corked and tarred in the hope of stopping the spread of the infection. A vain hope. During the first week, the log had recorded the burial of 14 convicts, the two remaining turnkeys, and a loblolly boy, all of whom had lived or worked forward, and it had recorded them in Needham's fine copperplate. Now it was Jack's far rougher hand that wrote the daily list, for his clerk had gone over the side with two cannonballs to carry him down and his hammock for a shroud, the first of those abaft the mast to die of the disease. Apart from the perpetual supply of fresh rainwater, the circumstances were as bad as they could be, with the enormous, oppressive heat, the dispirited, vitiated atmosphere, the excessive dread and general despondence that had come over all the crew. And when the disease struck the lower deck, it killed men faster than the plague. They gave up hope, and sometimes it seemed to Stephen that they would almost as soon not take his draughts, but would rather have it over as soon as might be. And soon it was, in many cases. Headache, languor, a moderate rise in temperature, and despair at once, even before the rash and the appalling fever, far worse in this stifling heat. And so onwards to what he often believed an unnecessary death. He believed this all the more since his heroic exhibitions of bark and antimony had begun to have effect. There were now 11 convalescents, men who had survived their crises. Yet in spite of this clear evidence, there were those who would die, who resigned themselves almost thankfully to death the moment they were brought in. "I believe," he said to Martin, "that if only a French ship could be seen approaching, if only we could hear the drum beat and the sounds of guns in earnest, several of our cases would cure themselves, and the admissions would fall off to a wonderful degree." "You're in the right," said Martin, taking up his book. "Spirit is three-quarters of the remedy, as Raises observes. But who can dose or measure spirit?" He pressed his hands to his eyes and went on. "Now, in the case of Roberts, you did say 20 drachms, did you not? I must note it down." 20 drachms it was. I am persuaded he can bear it. And pray do note it down. Our notes will be of capital importance. You've kept them very fully, I'm sure."
"I have indeed," said Martin wearily.
"Mr. Pulling, sir," said the new loblolly boy.
"Bring him in."
"Well, now, Lieutenant Pullings, my dear, you have a vile headache. You feel cold, a distinct rigour about the midriff and in the limbs."
"Just so."
"You've come to the right shop," said Stephen, smiling. "You're slightly affected, and we can take you in hand in time. We have a prime physic that will suit your case and belay it with all nines. And you are to observe, Tom, that I will lay 100 to 1 upon your hoisting your flag in time. Pullings never gets a die." An hour later, Martin asked Dr. Maturin to take his pulse. He did so. They looked at one another, and Stephen said, "I'm not sure. There are many other possible causes. You've eaten nothing since yesterday evening. Take some soup and stay below. I shall go on deck this time." He took his best coat off the cleat and put it on, for the leopard still did these things in the proper manner. He walked along the gangway towards the range of bodies sewn into their hammocks, as Fisher's white surplice showed on the quarterdeck. Stephen didn't go farther aft than the main tack block, but stood there with his hat off while the service was read, and the dead seamen moved down the slide into the viscid water. After this he conversed with Jack at a distance of some 10 yards, easy enough in that still air and that silent ship, and paced for a while on the forecastle. By the time he returned to the sick bay, there was no doubt remaining as to Martin's state.
"You will take our 20 drachms," he said.
"I will even adventure upon 25," said Martin, "and my notes will show its progress from within." From that day onwards, Stephen was alone. He had two literate assistants, Herapath and, to some degree, Fisher, but neither was a medical man, neither could compound his drugs nor judge their administration, and in neither could he confide when the enormous demand exhausted his medicine chest, so that he was obliged to turn to placebos, mostly of powdered chalk coloured blue or red. Day and night ran to one, separated only by those pauses when Fisher put on his surplice and followed the dead on deck to bury them. Although, even before Martin's death, the physic was no more than nominal, the immediate bodily and spiritual care, the nursing of the patient still remained, and to this he applied himself, teaching Herapath all he could. For, as he remarked, nursing was quite half the battle. It had saved Martin, who in fact died from a pneumonia that struck him days after the favourable termination of the crisis, and after he'd written an exact description of the disease from the onset to the first stage of convalescence, the Latin faultless to the last. It seemed an endless battle. Yet by the calendar only 23 days passed before an even more violent deluge than usual brought a northerly breeze in the morning watch that wafted the leopard down just to the very outside limit of the region where the southeast trade wind blew. From the sick bay he noticed the deafening downpour, water knee-deep on the decks and cascading into the head, and he heard all hands pipe to make sail in the ensuing quietness. But this had happened so often that he paid little attention. Even when he felt her heavy, deeply weeded bulk surge on, and heard the growing hiss of her cutwater shearing through the swell, he was too utterly weary to be pleased, just as he had taken no real satisfaction in the diminishing mortality of these last few days and the absence of fresh cases. He slept where he sat, occasionally waking for some call for water, or to help a half-seen assistant lash a delirious man into his cot. Yet when he woke in the morning, he knew that the ship was in a different world, that she was herself a different world. True, clean, breathable air was gushing down the windsail. His whole being was recharged with life. These confused waking motions were confirmed on deck. The Leopard had sent up her t'gallant masts. It had taken the reduced crew 3/4 of an hour instead of the usual 17 minutes and 40 seconds, and she was running west-sou-west at 5 or 6 knots under a cloud of sail. A new and brilliant day, a new and healthy sea, transparent tonic air, the ship alive. Killick had been on the watch, and now he ran forward with coffee-pot and biscuit, laid them carefully in a coil of rope at the appointed place, the limit of the forbidden ground, retreated and called out, "Good morning, sir. This is what we've been praying for." Stephen nodded, took a draught, and asked how the captain did. "Which is just turned in," said Killick, laughing like a boy. "Says we've cleared the doldrums, the true blessed trade," he says, "and never will he touch a stitch till we're at the Cape." Stephen drank his coffee and soaked his biscuit, standing by the rail. An extraordinary change had come over the ship. Men ran, talked in low, cheerful voices, looked like different beings. And there was laughter out on the bowsprit. All this time the routine of the ship had been carried on, but as though the hands were already at least half dead. Orders had been obeyed, but by slow and listless automata. Now the Leopard might have been sailing fresh from Porto Praya, apart from the fact that her decks were so thinly peopled.
The change in the sick bay was more surprising still. Men who had been on the point of death the evening before were now straining their heads up from their cots, talking eagerly in their weak, thin voices. One very feeble convalescent had actually reached the ladder and was attempting to creep up. The eyes, the expressions, the words that he encountered as he made his rounds possessed a vitality that he hadn't seen for weeks, and one whose existence had almost passed from his mind. "I doubt whether we have many fresh cases today," he said to Herapath. He was not mistaken. No more new admissions and only three more deaths, all cases where the coma had been abnormally prolonged. Nevertheless, it was a full week before he opened his plague-house, allowed his stronger convalescence to come up to the forecastle or return to the lower deck, and moved aft again. "Jack," said he, "I am come to sit with you a while. And then, if I may, I will beg the use of one of your little cabins. I long for a day and a night of uninterrupted sleep in luxury, swinging in an ample cot under an open skylight. You needn't be afraid. I've been pumped in fresh rainwater and soaped from head to foot, and I believe the epidemic is over. Should anything untoward occur, Herapath will wake me. Herapath knows all the symptoms now, as very few men know them. Herapath will not be deceived." "Now, sir," he cried, frowning sternly at a stranger whose face was reflected in a small-looking glass. "Jesus, 'tis myself behind that beard." A 3 weeks' beard. With his sunken, emaciated face, it gave him the look of an El Greco without the length. "Beard," he said, pulling it. "Maybe I shall retain this beard. The torment of the razor, a mere memory, no more. The Roman emperors retained their beards in war." At any other time, Jack would have pointed out the chasm separating a Roman emperor from a surgeon in the Royal Navy. But now he only said, "Herapath behaved very well, I collect. Very well indeed. A good, quiet, intelligent young man that can be relied upon. And since I am now alone, I desire you will make him my mate. True, he's not studied physic nor surgery, but he can read the Latin and the French in which most of my books are wrote, and he will have nothing to unlearn, which is not the case with most of the pitiable quackeens who come aboard with nothing more valuable than a piece of paper from Surgeon's Hall, a set of old wives' tales, and a second-hand saw." "I can't possibly make a man an assistant surgeon. What are you thinking of, Stephen? The sick and hurt had never countenanced it for a moment. But I'll tell you what I can do. I can rate him midshipman, since I have three vacancies, alas. And then he can be your acting mate." He went on to explain the metaphysics of acting and substantive rank. But finding that Stephen had fallen fast asleep, his chin on his chest, his mouth open among the beard, and no more than a thin crescent of yellowish white showing under his eyelids, he tiptoed away. The dawn broke clear and sudden, a brilliant sun rising at exactly 6 o'clock, the southeastern wind blowing fresh, and at the beginning of the forenoon watch, the Leopard crossed the line. Crossed without the least ceremony, however, nothing to mark the event apart from pork on what would have been a dried peas banyan day, and plumbed off. At 6 bells, Herapath brought the sick bay papers and reported uninterrupted progress forward. Before settling to their grim accounts, Jack said, "Herapath, Dr. Maturin speaks in high terms of your conduct, and he wishes you to continue as his assistant. The rules of the service don't allow me to enter you on the ship's books as assistant surgeon without the proper certificates, so I propose rating you midshipman. This will enable you to act as his assistant, to live with the oldsters in the after cockpit, and to walk the quarter-deck. Is that agreeable to you?" "I am very much beholden to Dr. Maturin for his good opinion," said Herapath, "and to you, sir, for your most obliging offer. But perhaps I should observe that I am an American citizen, in case that should be a bar."
"Are you, though?"
said Jack. He looked at the master, which he had opened to change Herapath's rating. "So you are. Born in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Well, I'm afraid that is a bar to your ever becoming a commissioned officer in the Royal Navy. I'm very sorry to have to tell you that advancement beyond master's mate is closed to you." "Sir," said Herapath, "I must endeavour to bear it." Jack looked at him sharply. No one but Stephen could make game of Captain Aubrey with impunity. But was Herapath, in fact, guilty of impertinence? The young man's face was calm and grave. There was no hint of a smile on Stephen's face either. "You have no dislike to fighting the French, I take it," he went on, "nor any of the other nations England is at war with?"
"None in the least, sir. In 98, when I was quite a boy, I was at arms against the French, under General Washington, and I'm happy to do what I can against any of your other enemies, unless, of course, England should go to war with the States, which, God forbid."
"Amen," said Jack. "Well, I shall be glad to welcome you to my quarter-deck. Mr. Grant will introduce you to the young gentleman. Here's a note for him. And since poor Stokes was just about your size, you may wish to buy his uniforms when they're sold at the mainmast." Herapath withdrew. They arranged their papers, and checking with the logbook, Jack wrote D.D., discharged dead, against the names of 116 men, ranging from William Macpherson, Lieutenant Royal Marines, and James Stokes, Master's Mate, down to Jacob Hawley, Boy, Third Class. It was a painful task, for again and again the name was that of some former shipmate who had sailed with them in the Mediterranean, the Channel, the Atlantic, or the Indian Ocean, sometimes in all, and whose qualities they knew intimately well. "One of the saddest things about this tally," said Jack, "is that it hits our volunteers so much harder than the rest. Once I knew a good third of the men aboard, now it's nothing like. Yet a surprising number of the quota men have come through. How do you account for that, Stephen?"
"I hazard a guess, no more. A slight attack of smallpox gives immunity, so these men, many of whom have been in prison, may have been infected with an attenuated form of jail fever, thus acquiring a resistance the others lacked. Yet I must confess that my reasoning is very loose, because of our convicts no more than three men have survived, and one of them will never make old bones. The women I reckon apart, for not only do they possess the singular toughness of their sex, but one at least is pregnant, a state that seems to confer immunity from so many ills."
Jack shook his head, looked through the remaining papers, and said, "These are your convalescents, I take it. How soon do you expect them to be fit for duty?"
"Alas, I cannot hold out any hope of a prompt return, except in the case of the few boys. The sequelae are very troublesome in this disease, I'm afraid. Troublesome and lingering. Of the 65 in my list, perhaps in other circumstances, you might have a score tolerably brisk in a month. Another score might take far longer. While the remaining 25, who only just came through, shouldn't be on a ship at all, whatever the circumstances, but in a well-appointed hospital." Jack wrote his sums and whistled at the result. "So at the best," he said, "I have about 200 men. I can watch perhaps 120 or so. 60 hands to a watch? God help us! 60 hands to a watch in a 50-gun ship. Yet we hear of merchantmen taking their goods to the ends of the earth with no more to sail their vessel. To sail her, yes. But to fight her, that's quite another thing.
We reckon the gun crews can handle 500 weight a man. Now, our long 24s weigh just over 500 weight, and our 12s 34. So to fight the ship one side, we need 110 men on the lower deck and 77 on the upper. To say nothing of the other side, all the carronades and the long nines. And as you know very well, Stephen, a great many people are needed to work her while she's being fought. This is a damned unpleasant kettle of fish.
It's worse than you suppose, Jack. Things are always worse than you suppose. For you are speaking as though my convalescence, my 65 convalescence, were presently to be restored. You did not notice that I spoke of other, of favourable circumstances. Now the present circumstances are not favourable, for I must tell you that my medicine chest is bare. I have no bark, no electuaries, no antimony, no... In short, I have nothing but my venereals and a little alba mistura, or eye wash. A very little alba mistura, and therefore cannot answer for my 80 convalescence at all. Unless they have physic and a diet that the ship cannot possibly provide in mid-ocean, a whole series of ailments may carry them away. This applies with the greatest force to my first list, the list on your right, headed by the name of Thomas Pullings, the list of those that require immediate relief. Can't they hold out until the Cape?
No, sir. Even in this clement weather, we already have the typical swollen leg by the dozen, the very dangerous debility, the severe nervous symptoms. In the cold winds and the boisterous weather south of Capricorn, without a drop of physic, my convalescence, or the greater part of them, would be condemned. And even if my chest were full, those on the first list would stand very little chance of seeing Africa.
Jack did not reply at once. His mind was dealing with the advantages and disadvantages of touching at a Brazilian port. The loss of the trade wind inshore, the way the southeaster would often hang in the east for weeks on end just under the tropic, so that a ship might have to beat into it tack upon tack for very little gain, or else run far south for the westerlies. A whole mass of considerations. His face was already sad. Now it grew stern and cold. And when he did speak, it was not to tell Stephen what he intended to do, but to ask whether Pullings and the people in the sick bay might be allowed wine yet. He was going to see how they did and would like to take a couple of dozen with him. Just when he reached his decision didn't appear, but it must have been before the first dog watch. Stephen brought Mrs. Wogan onto the poop, where he was obliged to repel a dangerous attack from Pollux, Babington's Newfoundland. Pollux didn't recognise him in his beard, and being attached to Mrs. Wogan, defended her as a matter of duty. Even when she seized its ear, pulled it away, and told it not to be a damn fool, the gentleman was a friend, the animal distrusted him and kept just behind his hams, uttering an organ-like growl, both with the inspiration and the outward breath. Babington was below, so when she'd reproached the dog and even thumped its loving head in vain, she tied a signal halyard round its neck and attached it to the fife rail. They moved aft to stare at the wake. And standing there, they heard the aged carpenter, busy at the larboard stern lantern, say to one of his mates, "What's the buzz, Bob?" Mr. Gray was somewhat deaf, and his mate was obliged to whisper, "We're bearing up for Recife," in a louder tone than he could have wished. "Hey?" said the carpenter. "Don't mumble, God pound you alive. Articulate, Bob, articulate. Recife. But only touch and go. No watering, no cattle. Green stuff, belike."
"I hope there'll be time to get Mrs. Gray a poll parrot," said the carpenter. "She grieved after her last poll parrot, something cruel. Look at this here therapiece, Bob. Would you ever have believed that even the dockyard could pass such a rotten bit of wood? And the whole bleeding stern post's the same. Punk! Incest's nothing to them, nor Sunday travel, so they get us to sea in an ancient sieve, the fucking bastards.
Bob coughed significantly, gave Mr. Gray a great jerk with his elbow and said, "Company, Alfred, company." The rumour about the Leopard's destination, like most ship's rumours, was quite accurate. Her head pointed farther west, away from Africa. She brought the wind well abaft the beam and began to set her upper and lower stunsails. But just as she moved much more heavily through the water now that she had a vast beard of doldrum weed to drag along, so the diminished watch spent a far longer time in sheeting home. Indeed, they'd scarcely coiled all down before the drum beat for quarters. And after that ceremony, her thin, hesitant gunfire was very different from the full-throated roar of a month ago. In the evening, Jack told Stephen that he'd decided to put into the nearest Brazilian port and asked him to prepare his list of drugs. "We're well found in stores and water," he said, "and I mean only to lie in the outer road just long enough to get your physic. And if you tell me that it's of the first necessity to put those invalids you name on shore. If this wind holds, we should raise Saint Roque tomorrow, and if it don't come foul inshore, Recife very shortly afterwards. The moment I've finished working out the new watch list with Grant, I shall start writing home. Have you any messages?"
"Love, of course," said Stephen.
The next day, having made his rounds, he said, "Mr. Herapath, the captain tells me that we are to stop at Recife in Brazil, where we may replenish our medicine chest. I shall spend much of my time drawing up a statement of our requirements and writing letters. May I therefore beg you to attend Mrs. Wogan to the poop, the unfortunate lady who is confined in the orlop above the tiers?"
"Sir?
You are not yet quite familiar with our sea terms, I find," said Stephen with great complacency. "I mean the floor below this, in about the middle, and the door is on your right-hand side, or, as we say, the starboard. No, the larboard, since you'll be going backwards. Well, never mind, let's not be pedantic, for all love. It's a small little door with a square hole in the bottom of it, a scuttle, along the passage where there was a marine forever walking up and down at one time. But perhaps you will never find it. I remember years ago, before I became so amphibious an animal, that I wandered in the depths of a vessel much smaller than this, my mind strangely perplexed. Come, I'll show you the way and present you to the lady."
"Don't trouble, sir. Oh, pray don't trouble," cried Herapath, suddenly bursting out of his silence. "I know the door perfectly. I have often remarked that particular door. It is on the way from here to the after cockpit where I now sling my hammock. Pray don't give yourself the trouble."
"Here is the key," said Stephen. "You will make my compliments, if you please." Mrs. Wogan's appearance under the conduct of the surgeon's mate excited a certain amount of discreet curiosity on the quarter-deck, and much more envy. The older midshipmen still ached for her. Their captain didn't beat for the sport of it. But even so, more than one of them found it necessary to visit the poop to make sure that the ensign staff was still there, and the taffrail. She was observed to be in remarkable looks, and although she was decently subdued, as the Leopard's circumstances required, she and her companion seemed to have a great deal to say to one another. Three times her absurd gurgling laugh was heard, and three times the whole quarter-deck, from the officer of the watch to the grim old quartermaster at the con, smiled like fools. The third time the sound of the cabin door wiped the smile off their faces. They moved over to the leeward side with sober looks, for the captain was among them. The captain glanced at the sky, the set of the sails, the binnacle, and began his habitual pacing fore and aft, cocking an eye at the masthead every turn, in expectation of a hail. Again the laugh began, low but quite near by the poop rail.
It went on and on, swelling, rolling in pure amusement. And for the life of him, he couldn't resist. Disagreeable though his situation was, and heavy his mind, he felt an answering catch in the region of his stomach and turned square to windward.
Now, why in God's name I have to come at the grim old stoic would be hard to say, he remarked to himself.
Then, finding that the inward heave would not be quiet, he stepped forward to the shrouds of the mainmast, laid his coat on a gun, swung himself over the bulwark, over the hammocks and their netting, and walked composedly up the ratlins.
"Lord," he said as he mounted, "I've scarcely been aloft this commission." "That is how captains get fat and ill-conditioned. Ill-tempered, bilious Jupiter Tonans." He was old enough not to have to hurry, not to have to outdo a 20-year-old upper yardsman. And that was just as well, for as he paused in the top, he found that he was already puffing hard. He glanced at his paunch, shook his head, and then looked down at the quarterdeck. "Mr. Forshaw," he called, picking out his youngest midshipman, a first voyager, a slow, stupid, unhappy child, "bring me up my glass." He waited, nothing loath, until the boy's anxious head appeared. With a violent, perilous writhe, Forshaw brought his short legs over the rim, landed in the top, and mutely offered the telescope. It was clear to Jack that for the moment the boy couldn't bring out a steady word in spite of his studied calm.
"Now I come to think of it, Mr. Forshaw," he said, "I haven't seen you skylarking with the other reefers. Do you find the height disturbs you?"
He spoke quite kindly in a tone of conversation, but even so Forshaw's face turned scarlet and he gave a hopelessly confused answer. "It was terrible, sir. He didn't mind it at all."
"Nelson could do this sort of thing," thought Jack, "but I doubt that I can." Nevertheless, he went on, "the great point is not to look down until you have the knack of it, and to hold on to the shrouds with both hands, not the ratlins. Now, come along with me to the t'gallant cross-trees. We'll take it easy." Up and up towards the sky. "You'll find it much like the stairs at home presently. Look up all the time. Don't hang on too hard. Breathe easy. Handsomely round the futtocks now. Always take the outer t'gallant shrouds. There now. Put your arm round the heel of the royal. That's the royal mast, you see. Sometimes we step it abaft the t'gallant running right down to the cap, but that means more weight aloft, and sit on the jacks. They serve to spread the royal shrouds. There. Ain't that prime?" He stared over the enormous expanse of ocean at the western horizon, and there, exactly where it should be, lay a dark mass, firmer than any cloud. He unslung his telescope, and in the glass, Cape Sarok assumed its well-remembered form, the perfect landfall. "There," he said, nodding towards it, "that is America. You may go down now and tell Mr. Turnbull. It's much easier going down because of gravity, but you must look up all the time." Now and then he glanced down at the round face gazing religiously up, and beyond the face to the deck, long, thin and wonderfully remote, a white-rimmed sliver in the sea with little figures moving on it. But most of the time he stared at the cape. "How I hope to God that Stephen will let Pulling stay," he said aloud. "A year or so with that fellow Grant as my first would be..." The lookout's hail broke his train of thought, for by now the cape was visible from the yardarm below him, and he heard the cry, "On deck there, land 2 points on the starboard bow!"
From this time on, the more loving family leopards took to pen and ink. And those who couldn't write dictated to their learned friends, sometimes in plain English, but more often in terms as stilted and official as they could contrive, and those uttered in a hieratic tone. According to his promise, Stephen passed on Mrs. Wogan's request that she might add a letter to the rapidly filling bay. "I shall be interested to see what it contains," he said. And, as he expected, Jack turned away. Turned fast, but not quite fast enough to hide his expression of extreme distaste, that of something very near contempt. Captain Aubrey would do his utmost to deceive an enemy by the use of false colours and false signals, by making him believe that the ship was a harmless merchantman, a neutral or a compatriot, and by any other ruse that might occur to his fertile mind. All was fair in war. All, except for opening letters and listening behind doors. If Stephen, on the other hand, could bring Bonaparte 1 inch nearer to the brink of hell by opening letters, he would happily violate a whole mail coach full. "You will read captured dispatches with open glee and exultation," he said, "for you concede that they are public papers. If you value candour, you must therefore admit that any document bearing on the war is also a public paper. You are to rid your mind of these weak prejudices." In his heart, Jack remained unconvinced. But Stephen received the letter. He sat there with it in his hands in the guarded privacy of the great cabin as the Leopard lay off Recife early in the morning, well out in the roadstead, with the reef that guarded the inner anchorage the best part of a mile away. The first sight of it struck him with a wholly unexpected force, for it was addressed to Diana. He'd never thought of this possibility, had supposed their acquaintance to be slight, and it was some minutes before he could compose himself and set about the seal. Seals and their attendant pitfalls had few mysteries for him, and this one required no more than a thin, hot knife. Yet even so he had to break off twice because of the trembling of his hands. If the letter contained proof of Diana's guilty mind, he thought it would kill him. At first reading, it contained nothing of the sort. Mrs. Wogan exceedingly lamented the sudden parting from her dearest Mrs. Villiers, the event itself too dreadful and distressing to recall, and at one moment she had thought they were to be separated by the distance between this world and the next, for in her distraction at the sight of those odious ruffians, Mrs. Wogan had fired off a pistol, or even two, and another had exploded of its own accord, and that, it appeared, turned a dispute over a harmless piece of gallantry into a capital crime. But, however, her lawyers had handled the matter very cleverly, and kind friends had come to her support, so that they were to be separated only by the distance of half this present world, and that perhaps not for very long. Mrs. Villiers would remember her kindly to all their friends in Baltimore, particularly to Kitty Van Buren and Mrs. Taft, and she would be so obliging as to tell Mr. Johnson that all was well, and that, as he would hear from Mr. Coulson in more detail, no irreparable harm had been done. The voyage had begun in the most shocking manner, and they had had the plague aboard, but for some time now things had been going better. The weather was delightful, her stores were holding out to admiration, and she'd made friends with the surgeon. He was an ill-looking little man, and perhaps he was aware of it, for he had now allowed a horrid beard to overspread his countenance, quite frightful to behold. But one could grow used to anything, and his conversation was an agreeable break in the day. He was polite and generally kind, yet he could be snappish, he could give a short answer, although hitherto she'd not dared to be impertinent, nor anything but most perfectly meek. He didn't need fending off, as sailors would say, far from it, and she believed he must have a wounded heart. He was not married, that she could find. A learned man, but, like some others she'd known, quite preposterously thoughtless in many of the common things of life.
He'd put to sea for a 12-month voyage without a single pocket handkerchief. She was hemming him a dozen out of a piece of cambric she had by her. She believed she must have a tendre for the man. Certainly she was disappointed when the knock was followed not by the doctor, but by the chaplain, a man with Judas-coloured hair and two left legs, who had been paying her a great deal of the most unwelcome attention, sitting with her and reading good works aloud. For her part, Mrs. Wogan perfectly loathed the combination of incipient gallantry and the Bible. She had seen too much, far too much, of that in the States. Mrs. Wogan was not a bread-and-butter miss fresh from the schoolroom, and she knew what he would be at. Otherwise, her life was not too disagreeable. Monotonous, of course, but it was not the insufferable tedium of her last years in the convent. Her maid had amusing tales of the very lowest conceivable, or rather inconceivable, life in London. There was a dear fool of a dog that marched up and down the poop with her, and a nanny goat that sometimes condescended to say good day. She had a good store of books, and she had actually read right through Clarissa Harlowe without hanging herself, though that was sometimes only for want of a convenient hook, without looking to see how the ninny would escape that vile coxcomb Lovelace. How Mrs. Wogan despised conscious good looks in a man, and without skipping a line, a feat surely unparalleled in the female world. Indeed, were dear Mrs. Villiers ever in the same unfortunate predicament, Mrs. Wogan could advise nothing better than Richardson's works entire, together with Voltaire's as an antidote and an unlimited supply of Naples biscuits. But Mrs. Villiers was to believe that for her the very opposite. A life of total freedom in the company of a well-bred, intelligent man was the constant wish of her most affectionate friend, Louisa Wogan. The first reading showed no guilt in Diana, rather the reverse. The letter was obviously designed to keep her in the dark. His heart had already absolved her, but his mind insisted upon a second reading, much slower, and a third, very carefully analysing the words and searching for those minute marks and repetitions that might betray a code. Nothing. He leant back, quite satisfied. The letter wasn't candid, of course. And the most obviously uncandid thing about it, the absence of Herapath, pleased him extremely. Mrs. Wogan knew that there was some risk of the letters being read by the captain. She certainly didn't share his weak prejudices, and if she had any delicate information to convey, she meant to do so by means of Herapath. It was very probable that she should wish to enlarge upon the no irreparable harm and to tell her chief just how much she had been obliged to give away to save her neck. Any agent worth a straw would do the same. Any agent, that is to say, who had not been bought. And Mrs. Wogan had not been bought. Furthermore, he had given her plenty of time to prepare her lover. He copied the letter for Sir Joseph, whose cryptographers might find a code where his close inspection, his heating of the paper and his chemicals had detected none. Then he replaced the seal and put the letter back in the bag. At the same time, looking through the recent editions for a cover addressed in Herapath's distinctive hand. There was nothing. "Jack," he said, "is there to be any shore leave?" "No," said Jack. "I shall call on the governor, of course, and do the civil, and I shall see whether I can get a few hands in the port. Otherwise, the only people to go ashore will be you and whatever invalids you absolutely insist on landing." He looked earnestly into Stephen's face at this point and then went on, "I don't mean to lose a minute, and I don't mean to lose a single man by desertion. You know how they run if they're given half a chance." "Here are the names of those that must go,"
said Stephen. I examined them with great care not an hour ago.
How I shall tell Pullings, I don't know, said Jack, looking at the list. It'll fairly break his heart.
Heartbroken, he seemed, as he was handed down the side in a canvas bag to join the others in the hired tender. He was too weak even to sit up, and that was a comfort to him because he could lie with his face concealed. Few others were quite so reduced, but all were pitiable sights, and many were as fractious as ill-conditioned children. One ailiff, as Stephen eased him into the sling, called out, "Handsomely, handsomely, you bearded pishcart, handsomely, can't you?" Stephen might have saved his life, but the surgeon's fell shears had also sliced off a pigtail of 10 years' patient growth and cultivation, and now, with the sun beating down on his bald white pate, the loss was very present to Aleph's peevish mind.
"Take that man's name," cried the new first lieutenant. "Take it yourself, you old French fart," said the seaman, "and stuff it up. There ain't no flogging here."
The other invalids went down the side in disapproving silence. For although in extreme illness, unexpected, unusual emergency or drunkenness, they too might throw discipline aside, this was coming it pretty high. Higher than the state of things allowed. After all, the ship wasn't on fire, nor had she struck, nor was Aleph roaring drunk. Stephen was about to follow them when Herapath said, "May I come with you, sir?"
"You may not, Mr. Herapath," said Stephen. It was stated that there was to be no shore leave, and the transcription of our records calls for all your time, all your powers. You miss nothing. Recife is a most uninteresting port."
"In that case, may I beg you to be so kind as to leave this with the Consul of the United States?" He produced a letter. Stephen put it in his pocket. Late, late that night, with no sound in the ship but the trade wind singing quietly in the rigging, the occasional movement of the anchor watch, the bells and the cry of "all's well" from the sentries that followed each half-hourly stroke, Stephen snuffed his candle, pressed his hands to his aching, red-rimmed eyes, took up his diary and wrote, "I have seen Jack glow with pleasure when he's made a perfect landfall, when he's calculated his tides, his currents, and his shifting winds, and the event proves him right. And for this once my prediction, too, has been as exact as I could wish." Poor lady, how she must have laboured with her coding, and how heartily she must have cursed Fisher when he would be reading her South on resignation. Judging from what she had not time to encode, I believe Sir Joseph's experts will extract a remarkably complete picture from the rest, and that he will be gratified by the spectacle of a nascent system of intelligence. Infant steps, perhaps, but surely those of a promising, even of a prodigious infant. I feel for her with that good man prosing on and on, and her precious moments racing by. Her seal, though artful enough with its double guard of hair, showed evident marks of impatience. When we meet tomorrow, I have little doubt that our eyes will match, like those of a pair of albino ferrets. For although my copies and my letters to Sir Joseph in duplicate may have been longer, I am more accustomed to the act than she. I do not have to count on my fingers for my code, blot and write again with little calculations in the margin, nor did I have to contend with extreme vexation of spirit. I must keep the triumph from my glowing eye, however. Perhaps I shall wear green spectacles. He closed his book, itself a monument of cryptography, and lay down in his cot. Sleep was welling up to douse his mind. But for a while it still burned clear,
reflecting both upon the satisfactions of his trade and upon its very dirty sides. The constant dissimulation, the long-lived lie soaking into the liar's deepest fibre, however justified the lie, the sacrifice, in some cases he'd known not only of the agent's life, but also of his private essence, upon whales, upon the curious division of the wardroom into two parties, Grant, Turnbull and Larkin on the one side, and Babington, Captain Moore and Byron, the new acting fourth lieutenant, on the other, with the purser Benton and the insignificant marine lieutenant Howard in between. Perhaps Fisher, too. Although of recent days his friendship with Grant had increased. An odd creature, the chaplain. Perhaps somewhat shallow, unsteady. His conduct during the height of the epidemic had disappointed Stephen, as far as he had had time to be disappointed. More promise than performance. Too much taken up with his own troubles. More willing to receive comfort than to give it. Certainly most reluctant to handle filth. And this marked concern for Mrs. Wogan's welfare. They were not parties opposed by any animosity, however, at least not evident animosity. They rather represented different attitudes, and they were probably to be found throughout the ship, with Jack's old shipmates and volunteers on the one hand and the rest of the crew on the other. Will he find any more men? Was the last of these thoughts that had coherent form. The next day brought the answer. 12 black Portuguese. And Jack was to try again in the afternoon, his last chance before the Leopard sailed on the evening tide. But, observed Bondon, rowing Stephen to the apothecary's for his final lading, I doubt he'll find another soul. May he not press some from the English ship that's just come in? Oh, no, sir, said Bondon, laughing. Not in a foreign port, he can't. Besides, she's a whaler for the South Sea, so most of her men'll have protections, even if we meet her far out in the offing. Nor he won't get no volunteers out of her neither, not for the old Leopard, if they haven't sailed with him before. No, no, they won't go into the Leopard of their own free will, not an old vessel of her unlikely rep. But surely she's a very fine ship, better than you, the captain said. Well, now, said Bondon, I don't go for to set myself up as a King Solomon, but I know what the common chap that has used the sea for some time says to himself. He says, this here old Leopard may have a good skipper. No preachy, floggy hard horse, as we say, but she's very old and cruel short-handed. We shall be worked to the bone, so damn the Leopard. For why? Because she's a floating coffin and unlucky at that. Nay, Bondon, the captain told me distinctly, and I recall his very words, that she'd been thoroughly overhauled with Snodgrass's diagonal braces and Robert's iron plate knees, so that she was now the finest 50-gun ship afloat. As to her being the finest 50-gun ship afloat, why, fair enough, because why? Because there's only Grampus in the ring, bar two or three more we call the Baltic hearses. But as for them knees and braces... Well, now, sir, said Bondon, glancing over his shoulder and shooting the boat through a gap between a mob of small craft and the outer buoy. He didn't speak again for some while, and when he did, it was to say in an obstinate, contentious voice, they can talk to me about Captain Seymour and Lord Cochrane and Captain Host and all the rest of them, but I say our skipper's the finest fighting captain in the fleet. And I served under Lord Viscount Nelson, didn't I? I'd like to see the man that denies it. Who wiped the Spanish frigate's eye and a 14-gun brig and made her strike? Who fought the Polycrest till she sunk under him and swapped her for a corvette cut from right under their guns? I know, Bondon, said Stephen mildly. I was there. Who set about the French 74 in a 28-gun frigate? Cried Bondon, angrier still. But then, he went on in quite another tone, low and confidential. When we're ashore, sometimes we're a little at sea, if you understand me, sir. Which,
being as straight as a die. We sometimes believe them quick-talking coves are dead honest, too, with their patent knees and braces and goddamn silver mines. Pardon the expression, sir. Now, 'tis natural for any captain to think his command the finest ship that ever was. But sometimes, being stuffed up with knees and braces, we might perhaps think are finer than his quiet reason, and believe it and say it too, without a lie. Leopard! Called the master of that fine American bark, Thiesa Fuchs, who recognised the boat. R.C. Fox, replied Bondon, with an offensive variation of the name, and a scornful laugh. Do you lack for any hands? We got 3 Liverpool Irishmen aboard and a quartermaster that ran from the Melampus. Why don't you come and press them? Merriment aboard the bark and cries, a bloody old leopard. From the look of your topside in your harbour, Stowe, said Bondon, now abreast of the Ace of Fuchs, you ain't got a single seaman in the barkie for us to take. My advice to you, old Boston Bean, is to go right back to sodden Massachusetts by foot and try and find a real sailorman or two. A general roar from the Ace of Fuchs, a bucket of slush thrown in the direction of the boat, and Bondon, who had never at any time looked at the American, said, that's settled his hash. Now, where to first, sir? I must go to the apothecary, the hospital, and the American consul. Pray choose the point most nearly equidistant from all 3. To this point, no later than Bondon, from long experience, had expected him to be, Stephen returned, bearing a parrot for the carpenter. He was followed by 2 slaves carrying drugs enough to dose the whole ship's company for 18 months, and by 2 nuns with an iced pudding wrapped in wool. 10,000 thanks again, dear mothers, he said. This is for your poor, and pray for the soul of Stephen Maturin, I beg. To the slaves, gentlemen, here is for your trouble. Commend me to the esteemed apothecary. To Bondon, now homewards, if you please, and ply your oars like Nelson at the Nile. When they cleared the inner harbour, and the roadstead came into sight, he said, now there's the odd boat quite close to our leopard. Bondon replied with an amiable grunt, no more, and after a quarter of a mile, Stephen went on, in all my seagoing experience, I've never seen so odd a boat. At the thought of all Dr. Maturin's seagoing experience, Bondon gave a secret smile and said, is that so, sir? It's like a brig with 2 masts, you understand, but they're arsy-versy. Bondon looked over his shoulder. His expression changed. He took 2 powerful strokes, and as the boat glided along, he stared again. She's one of our frigates, and she's lost her foremast at the partners. Jory bowsprit, and her head's all a who. Nymph. 32, if I don't mistake, a fine sailor. He did not mistake. The Nymph, Captain Fielding, from the Cape for Jamaica with dispatches, and so home, had run into a Dutch 74, the Varkzaamheid, in a blinding rainstorm just north of the line. There'd been a brief action in which the Nymph's foremast had been wounded, but by carrying all the sails she dared, she'd clean outrun her much heavier opponent in a 2 days' chase. By the time the Dutchman hauled his wind and gave over, the Nymph was close in with the shore, and a little later a freakish gust off Cape Branco took her aback, bringing her foremast by the board. Fortunately, the Dutchman was quite out of sight, last seen steering south, chasing no more. And Captain Fielding had brought his ship down to Recife to refit before continuing his journey. Fielding was senior to Jack. In his opinion, no good purpose could be served by whipping up a jury foremast and putting to sea in company with the Leopard to search for the Varkzaamheid. Apart from the fact that the Nymph was carrying dispatches, which prohibited her from going in chase of wild geese, the Dutchman sailed faster than the Leopard, though not so fast as the Nymph, and Fielding had no wish to lie there being clawed by a 74 while the Leopard came lumbering up. particularly as she was so short-handed as to be little use when she got there. Nor could he spare the leopard any hands. Aubrey would find plenty at the Cape. And were he in Aubrey's place, he would give the Vaxenhyde a wide berth. She was a fair sailor, commanded by a determined fellow who understood his business, and she was well manned. She had given the Nymph 3 broadsides in little over 5 minutes. Their parting was rather cold, although Jack did regale him with the greater part of Stephen's pudding, an act which, as Jack himself observed, had few equals in the course of naval history, the present heat and all circumstances being borne in mind. "For my part, I rejoice," said Stephen, as the Leopard fished her best bower and America faded on the western sky. "I had messages of some consequence, and that swift-sailing, cautious Nymph will carry my duplicates much faster than the originals."